I'm going to call the meeting to order. I don't have a gavel, so I hope you'll just respect my voice. Will the CLA take the roll? Or do we not have to do that, Travis?
Yeah, and I think now that we've established, if people would like to do it so we know who's on the call for members, we can do that. We'll just ask everybody else to be quiet. That way the members of the public know who is on the call for members.
Okay. Josh, go ahead.
All right, just a sec here. We'll get this going. All right, so we're going to start. Representative Mahoney.
Here.
Representative Neuer.
Here.
Representative Gunther.
Here.
Representative Backer
here.
Representative Baker.
Here.
Representative Claflin.
Here.
Representative Dabney.
Here.
Representative Eklund.
Here.
Representative Haley.
Here.
Representative Hassan. Representative Cagle. Here. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick present.
Representative Mecklen.
Mecklen present.
Representative Moran. Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Sundin.
Sundin present.
Representative Stevenson.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Representative Zhang present.
Representative Moran. Representative Cagle. Representative Hassan. The roll is set, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Josh. I would ask that someone approve the minutes from May 8th. I know everyone has read them, has dispersed to us. Would anyone care to move the minutes?
Chair Mahoney, this is Representative Mike Sundin. I so move the minutes of the previous meeting.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. Hearing none, the minutes are approved. Members, we have four items on our agenda today. Many of them are very important for people. We do not have the actual bill in our possession, so there'll be no motion such as to roll over into an omnibus bill or approve for and sent to Ways and Means. But with our special session coming up, and all of these have the opportunity to move to the floor if we can find agreement on them. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call upon Representative Stevenson to start with his proposed language for the Small Business Grants Program. So Representative Stevenson, if you will go over this.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, before we begin, could I ask a question?
Sure. Any questions?
This is Representative Kosnick, and I appreciate you reaching out to all the members on our side and gathering questions and concerns if we had some. Absent any agreement on today's discussion items.
Representative Kosnick, you broke up.
Yeah, somebody else unmuted.
Any
absent any agreement, what would be the path for this? Is it likely that the governor would just act on his own behalf at that point then?
Ensure that it's the right path.
for those who are not muted, please mute your phones. My understanding, as it has been explained to me by leadership, if we find agreement on this bill, it will be introduced on the during the special session and be voted upon. You know, we have to get a majority to suspend the rules and then pass it on to the governor to have him sign it. I don't think there's any pathway at this particular point for the governor to act upon this. There is a meeting tomorrow, and I can't remember the acronym. It could speed it up by a couple of days if they act upon it or pass it. But by and large, this would be the formula that the governor would use, and then we would authorize it by a vote during special session.
Okay, thank you, Chair Mahoney. And then just wanted to clarify whether this was kind of a preliminary step leading to ultimately an executive order, regardless of what we as the legislature decide or not. So thank you for that clarification.
Sure. Are there any other questions about procedures? Hearing none. Again, I'll call on Representative Stevenson. You've got this particular bill. Please explain it, and then we'll bring forth your, I think you have four, there's four witnesses today to this, so.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Representative Stevenson, before you start, my apologies. Representative Moran and Hassan have joined the hearing, and Representative Cagle has been here. I think there were some technical concerns. I just wanted to clarify who is in the meeting. So, like I said, Representative Moran and Hassan have joined us. So you can go ahead, Representative Stevenson.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Happy to come back to you and talk about the proposed relief fund for small businesses in Minnesota that have been impacted by the efforts to control the COVID-19 pandemic. This is a bill that, of course, this committee heard several weeks ago before the end of session, and that passed as part of the economic security package about a week before the end of session. Since then, Representative Mahoney, myself, others have been in conversations with Senator Pratt, Senator Anderson, and others in the Senate. I believe we are extremely close to a final agreement as to what the language will look like in a final package here, an agreement with the Senate. Obviously, as was discussed when we heard this bill last, this is a major need for businesses across Minnesota that have been devastated by the pandemic and have been shut out from some of the relief funds that were made available, in particular by the federal government, where a lot of that money went to well-connected insider organizations, and the small businesses were left behind with nothing. Perhaps with that introduction, I'll just walk through the agreement. The bill creates a fund totaling $62.5 million, of which $2.5 million comes from the Small Business Emergency Loan Guarantee Program that we created in the first or second round of COVID response bills back in late March, I believe. An additional $60 million comes from federal funds that we received as part of the CARES Act. Those funds will be used to make grants to small businesses that have been impacted by the pandemic, and I'll say more about eligibility in a minute. I did want to pause because when we last looked at this bill, we were mostly looking at a forgivable loan program. We had some conversation in this committee about doing grants on a proposal that Representative Robbins brought forward, and I certainly like the fact that there were, you know, there wasn't a repayment obligation in the grant formulation, but we wanted to, at the time we were talking about doing forgivable loans because DEED already had a loan program that could just pump up and go forward. The reason why we switched to grants this time around was that we received guidance from the Federal Treasury Department and confirmation from the MMB that federal funds, the CARES Act funds, could not really be used for forgivable loans. And so we shifted to a grant model, understanding that that might still take a little bit longer time to stand up. So we have a total of $62.5 million. Funds will be split on a geographic basis, 50%, 50% metro and greater Minnesota, $30 million for each. There's a administrative cap on money that can be used to administer the program at about $2.2 million. We expect that the money transferring from the Small Business Emergency Loan Guarantee Program will go towards the administrative costs, as it's unclear whether the CARES Act money can be used for that. Speaking a little bit more to eligibility, who's eligible for these grants? Well, anyone who can demonstrate a financial hardship due to COVID-19 will be eligible for the grant, but the legislation gives priority to businesses that are unable to operate at least 51% capacity as of May 18th, which of course is the last day of the session. What that means in practical terms is priority will be given to bars, restaurants, salons, gyms, fitness centers, those places of public accommodation that were initially closed by executive orders 4 and 8 and are still not able to operate at full capacity today, but certainly weren't at on May 18th. Grants are up to $10,000, it's not a first come, first serve model. Instead, there'll be an application period of not more than 10 days. Everyone's got to get their paperwork in during that time. And then there will, if the amount of applications, eligible applications, exceeds the amount of money that's available, which is what we expect, then there will be a lottery. We feel that that's the fairest way to distribute these funds, to make sure that it's not well-connected insiders, or people with, you know, lobbyists and fancy lawyers who get the money, that everyone has equal opportunity. Of the $60 million in grants, there is some allocations to specific types of businesses. $18 million needs to go to micro businesses defined as 6 employees or less. $10 million to minority-owned businesses, $2.5 million to businesses owned by veterans, $2.5 million to businesses owned by women, and then $2.5 million going to help the cultural markets that are all over the state. And we talked a little bit about that the last time, it came through committee as well. The last thing that I would mention is that the bill does include Representative Eklund's bill to pay back the 21st Century Minerals Fund. That money, the payback would come out of any future budget surplus. Obviously, we have a budget deficit at the moment, but hopefully someday we'll be back in surplus, and then that money will be used to repay the 21st Century Minerals Fund. The nexus to this legislation is members of the committee will recall that the money came out of the 21st Century Minerals Fund to pay for the original Small Business Emergency Loan program that was established by executive order back in March. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer questions, or you mentioned there are other people to testify, and of course I'm happy they can testify, and then I can take questions, whatever the chair wants.
Representative Stevenson, why don't we take testimony? I think there's 3 or 4, and I think first on the list is Mike Tamale. Mr. Tamale, are you on the call?
Yes, I am, and I'm with Renee Dossman, Executive Director of Twin Cities Neighbor Development Center. So if Renee could go first, I'll hop on second, and we'll be quick. Thank you.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Ms. Dossman, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to it's good to see everyone again. We appreciate all of your hard work on this bill. I know this hasn't been easy. But I just wanted to kind of give you an update from when we last talked, and talk a little bit more about what's happening at the Midtown Global Market. So as it relates to, we've been a strong partner with the state legislature indeed. On the first round of SBL funding, we received $1.7 million, of which we made 55 loans. 70% of those were owners, business owners of color. 50% of those were micro businesses with six or fewer employees. We recognized what was happening with the PPP loans as well, and that the people that we support were not getting access to those loans. So we actually worked with CRF to put some of our, to get some of our entrepreneurs through. And then we just decided we would open up, because we're CDFI, and do our own PPP loans to assist those and to assist those entrepreneurs and help them with the application, help them get their documents together, translate information for them as it related to that. And we were, as a result of that, we were able to help 15 businesses, and we've been reaching out to our network to let them know that we are available to them to help them do more. We distributed about $500,000 in loan funds for the PPP out of our own loan fund. As it relates to, we've also been, part of what's been happening is we've been helping people, obviously, with the deed loans, helping with Hennepin County, City of Minneapolis, Ramsey County, et cetera. And just like what we're talking about here, the need's been greater. So then what happens is it turns into a lottery, and then people don't, it doesn't, everybody doesn't get the money. And so we've been reaching out even after the most recent events and just seeing what people need. And the feedback we're getting is, thank you for calling. We appreciate you calling, but you called me now five times talking about all of this different funding that's available to you, and we didn't get any of it. So within NDC, we're taking a look at how can we create our own loan fund to go targeted to make sure that, or grant to go targeted to make sure that people in our community and our entrepreneurs can receive that money. But it's just been really difficult for them to actually be able to assess it and access it because they've missed out in the lottery. And as we think about for MGM, you know, we had to shut down as a result of COVID. NDC, you know, deferred the rent. We've, you know, as a Midtown global market, we've actually, you know, tried to defer all our expenses and work with all of our creditors. And it's been difficult to try to do that and working with them. But, you know, paying critical payables as best we can, because we don't have the revenue coming in because the restaurants and the retail shops and MGM are not able to be open completely, you know, curbside and delivery. And then everything else has happened now. So that's put them in an even more precarious position. So now we are looking at, we know that we will be basically, you know, we're in a food desert now. A lot of the things around us have been destroyed. So we are actively working to get our the grocery stores that are the grocery retailers that we have in our in the market up and running. We got a great lead on getting them EBT if they need it, but expanding their space so they can have essentials, et cetera. We've also, if you think about the market, it's connected to Alina, and Alina's been home because of COVID, and so they aren't in the market. So even when we do open up, they're not expecting to come back until maybe fall, and they're really enjoying, not this is enjoyable necessarily on all fronts, but it's working extremely well for them with people working from home. So for our businesses that are in the market that rely on that line of business, it's going to be extremely difficult. So we, of course, have switched tactics and pivoted, which is the word of the day now, right? So working with all of our businesses on, you know, what's your delivery method? What are you doing from a technology perspective? We have tech packets going out. We had a lot of entrepreneurs that did not even have a web presence because it's too expensive and they couldn't afford it. So we're working to raise money to help them get a web presence. We're working with them on, like, what does your business need to look like post this? And then we're also just dealing with in the market, how do we keep everybody safe? What does that look like? How do we do temperature checks? Do we have enough PPE equipment? So just a lot that's on the market right now and a lot of expense. And one of the things that I'll share with you before I pass it along to Mike is You know, after the recent events, I had an opportunity to go down to the market and to see the outreach of the community at the market, and I needed that because it's been very difficult thinking about all those entrepreneurs that haven't been able to be open for many months now. So we saw the spirit of people coming out. We have makeshift food shelves right in front of the market right now. We're partnering with a couple other organizations, and so saw people dropping off a ton of food, saw people taking a ton of food. So I'm not giving up, and I believe in people, and I believe in the work that you all are doing. One of the other things that I'll end with that we did, just trying to get some business, you know, to these entrepreneurs, but more importantly, trying to show our support to those that are on the front line for COVID. We started a program called Meals for Medics, which I talked to you about a little bit before. But we started that program to give 50 meals a day to those at the Abbott Northwestern Hospital. And it helps the entrepreneurs because they can get paid for their food, but more importantly, it helps those that are on the front line. And to date, we've delivered over 2,100 meals. And we've had to pause because the market's closed again. But we hope to, when we are able to reopen safely, we want to start that back up again. But these entrepreneurs have dealt with a lot. And one more thing, and I'm sorry, I just thought of this. You could get the PPP and that's great, but until they change the forgiveness period, you know, until they change the period in which you have to use it, that's been really difficult for the entrepreneurs in the market because they got the money, but now they can't use it on payroll because they're not open and they don't have enough business to support the payroll. So it's a really vicious cycle that they're in. Not being able to really fully access that money. So we hope that that gets extended by the SBA so that they don't have to use it in 8 weeks and that they can use it. But even with us opening the doors, we are working tirelessly from a TA perspective to get those entrepreneurs thinking about how they do business differently because the people might not show up into the market in the way that they've had in the past with the closures of the Alina offices. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mike.
Thank you, Ms. Dawson. Mr. Tamale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be real quick here. First of all, again, as Renee said, we really appreciate the incredible amount of thought and effort and work that you've all put into crafting this bill, and in particular taking lessons from the first round of SBEL funding that you created, that went through DEED and then out through the network of groups like ours and LADC and the Initiative Foundations, etc. I mean, I obviously everybody was scrambling like crazy, put together a program, did our best across the board. But there were big lessons to be learned, and I think what you've done here with the carve-outs, the lottery, the public market help, et cetera, is really to be commended. Just a couple specific points that I want to mention. The help for the public markets, of which we run and own, we're part owner of the Midtown Global Market, and for 20 years we were part owner and manager of the Mercado Central, also on Lake Street, both of which are currently boarded up, as you know. Getting a grant will be extremely helpful for any of our operators, including us. We're all nonprofits. But the $250,000 cap in our case is going to cover less than half of our anticipated loss. That's our monthly rental income, and basically our monthly operating budget is $125,000. So $250,000 covers 2 months of that, which is great. But we're looking at a slow startup over the next number of months, as Renee just said. So if there's any way that cap could be increased even to $400,000, that would be a massive help for us. Secondly, I'm confused about one requirement that's in here, and maybe I'm just not reading it well, but there's a in that section about grants for the operators of the markets, using 50% to forgive rent for existing tenants. Yes, absolutely. Using it for maintaining existing tenants. Yes, absolutely. The part I'm the first condition is that all but 10,000 must be made as sub grants to existing tenants of the operator. I don't get what that adds in here, and I don't even get what that means, to be honest. So you don't have to answer it now, but if someone could maybe help me understand what that is trying to accomplish, and how is that different than, I mean, what we're going to do is forgive rent for all the months that we can, because tenants weren't even in them earning any money. So obviously what we're going to do is for our existing tenants, forgive their rent if we can get this funding. So anyway, that's just a quick question on there. And then the last point I was going to make is, in the first round of this SBEL, we got a 10% of the loans made as an administrative fee, and this is a significantly lower number now going forward. For the most part, that's absolutely fine, because making a grant is a whole lot easier than making a loan, and in particular, loans, we need to service them for 5 years. So there's a five-year tail on our responsibilities. And so we're basically okay with that. What it does ignore, though, is the technical assistance that we provided these businesses going forward. But that said, nobody can really complain about getting a grant, much less on our end being able to give them out. So we're basically okay with that. And with that, I'll wrap it up. Thank you very much for this chance to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Tamale. I believe Henry Yanaris is on deck here.
Yes, I am.
Is Henry on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Henry, you should probably introduce yourself so for the record, because I probably slaughtered your last name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Henry Jimenez, the Executive Director of the Latino Economic Development Center. We were also one of the certified D lenders that processed some of these loans, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago to the same committee. In that time frame, we have processed 41 loans to 41 businesses. The majority of them was to Latino business owners. Our smallest loan was for $10,000 up to the maximum of $35,000. So this this amount is actually a number that we're very comfortable with, and is one of the reasons why we also support your initiative here on this bill, and the way that it's broken down. What we've been doing is supporting our businesses, also applied to other revenue funding through municipal funds and county relief funds. That has taken a lot of our time, similar to NDC and other organizations similar to us. It seems like every week there's a different fund, and that's where our attention is going, and trying to support as many of our Latino businesses to apply to those. I also very much support the $2.5 million to go towards indoor retail spaces as that is included in this bill. I also do have some concerns about the limit at $250,000, but I will be the first to tell you that I appreciate that there's some attention going to these indoor retail spaces, because they house dozens of businesses, and many that we might not even know unless you actually visit them. And I hope that with this investment, not only the members of this committee, but folks across the state do come to Lake Street and do go into a Mercado Central and Midtown Global Market and support these businesses, because this is just an investment. We need to do more than just this. And it's what my attempt to, and the testimony that I gave a couple weeks ago, was I always saw this as the start. I can tell you that even more now, the need is more than this, and I know that all of you are aware of that. I've talked to some folks in Minneapolis, like Councilmember Cano, and I know that there's going to be a need of probably over $1 billion to be able to get our Lake Street back. I talked about not just saving businesses, but saving culture. And it's important that we save our Latino culture, our immigrant business culture, because this is our new Minnesota business culture. And I'm just thankful for the opportunity to be able to testify today in support of this bill. But I think all of our organizations learned a lot the last couple of weeks in how to process these loans and making sure that we're even faster. I believe that this next wave of funding will probably go faster than the first wave because we are have put all of our processes in place and we're ready. And I hope that this is not the first and last round of funds because we're going to need a lot more support. With that, I appreciate the time, Mr. Chair, and if there's any questions.
Thank you, Henry. We have a couple more testifiers, Mr. Zhang and Mr. Herr. Why don't we have Tu Zhang, and maybe I pronounced that incorrectly. But Mr. Zhang, would you care to inform us of your thoughts on this particular bill?
Sure. I hope you hear me well.
Yes, we do. Just introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
Okay, sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to have this time to testify. So before I start talking, I would like to have you understand a brief background of myself so that you can understand how the Montel Marketplace is coming along. My name is Chua Xiong. I am the owner of Montel Marketplace. Just 4 blocks north of the state capital. Back in the Vietnam War, my father was one of the U.S. allies serving the CIAs, and in 1975, when the CIA withdrew from Laos, I was only 7. Simultaneously, 2 months later, my father, along with the thousands of fathers who could not escape to Thailand following the CIA, took us to the jungle, and I have been suffering with the thousands of fathers in the jungle for 4 years. We have been running day here and night there, being chased, being killed every day. We have been dodging bullets for the 4 years, and we decided to escape to Thailand. And when we got to Thailand in 1979, I was about 12 years old. We lived in the camp for 7 years. And we decided to come to the United States in 1986. So my father took us to St. Paul here in 1986. I was 18, married, and after living in St. Paul with very little English for a little bit over 4 years, I was able to manage myself through a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, and from there start working and start accumulating every single dollar that I can. And in 1997, I started a grocery store by the name of Food Smart at the Unidale Shopping Center. On Dale Street and University Avenue, running that one for 7 years. I sold that one and started the Montel Marketplace. Started Montel Marketplace at the old Shaw Stewart Lumber Company at a cold lumber yard. No heating, air conditioning, no toilets, and every single dime that I have made and earned and saved so far, we invested in all to the marketplace. One particular month, we were paying $26,000 per month to Shaw Lumber. But however, tough that was, I was able to manage it day and night, night and day over at the marketplace and there 5 years. Now we're 16 years, and today we have made the Montel Marketplace a very vibrant marketplace, not only being shopped and cherished by the Hmong people, we're also been visited and shopped by a lot of community of colors, especially the new immigrants from Burma, which is the Korean community. Everything was all done by self-sustained and self-funding, and over the 16 years, we had never asked for any city, state, or federal funding. It was all family hardworking and family sweat equity, and we have been surviving, even including the 2008 market crash. We have been surviving. However, this COVID-19 is very difficult, is very different. We shut our business down since March the 27th until just May the 27th, and a lot of vendors are not able to do business, and during those 2 months that we closed, the vendors were not able to pay us. So can we go ask our vendors, such as Xcel Energy and stuff like that, to be postponing our bill? We did our best, but we could not. So even though we don't have revenue coming, we're still making payments. It is unfortunate that our small businesses are smaller than businesses. They also have a lot of English barriers, and they could not apply or qualify for PPP, the EIDL, or the St. Paul Bridge Loan. So basically, they did not qualify for nothing. They didn't get anything. It was just mainly by the landlord, which is us. Now, simultaneously, we are now faced with another closure of the looting and demonstrations. So it is very, very difficult. And we don't know how many people are going to be returning to the marketplace. And I think we will be having a very slow start. So we're really thankful for any resources that you can allocate for us at this time. Is very helpful. We have never been asking for any money, but this time we really do want the help of any resources that you may have allocated to us. $250,000 is some sort of money in there to help us out. However, today we have over 125 vendors, which is a total of over 200 small kiosk spaces, and we operate in a very high cost, being the fact that our buildings are just a lumber yard, and the buildings are not insulated, so and so and forth, and so our bills are very high. And $250,000 will help sometimes, but in the long run, we do not know how fast of a starting we will be in this particular case. And a lot of people's goods are spoiled in this during those 3 days, just the past 3 days. So it's very hard for us to do. If the vendors that could not come, we can replenish those vendors in a matter of 4 or 5 months, 6 months. But if the Montel marketplace is to go away, 44 years to America, we only have two places, which is the Montel and Mon Village. And I am not speaking on behalf of Mon Village because Mr. He is also on the line, so I will let him speak on Mon Village. But here, if the Montel marketplace is not surviving, if it goes away, well, who else is going to be investing, taking that risk for those community of colors? And we here are employing over 400 employees on a monthly basis. And if the marketplace is going away, it's going to be affecting a ripple effect of, for example, we the Montel marketplace itself has been sustaining large bills such as $20,000 per month for Xcel Energy. And so those local vendors are benefiting big time from us, just the Montel. And now the 200 vendors that have been buying goods, reselling, buying goods from national wholesalers and international wholesalers. If the Montel marketplace goes away, it's going to be very hard to get another marketplace to be operated again. So it's going to be a ripple effect, and I'm really thankful for any resources you can allocate to help us out at this particular moment. And should you wish to come and visit, because we're only 4 blocks away from the state capitol, I welcome any one of you to make an appointment or to come and visit us. And we have 15 restaurants, we have over 50 farmers market on the outside, and we have over 125 vendors all year round. We never shut down one single day, including American holidays, for the last 16 years. And we really wish to continue the marketplace, and we are going to be here forever, and we'd like to be here forever. We'd like to be good citizens, and we'd like to chase after the American dream. Anything you can do to help us out will be really appreciated. So this is it that I'd like to say, and I am turning the mic back to you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can members ask questions? I have a couple questions for the testifier, Mr. Zhang.
Certainly go ahead, but I would like to get through the other two testifiers before we get too deep into questions. So if you have some that we can't call them back, go ahead.
Yeah, and then if, you know, the testifiers, maybe if they could.
We're hoping that they'll stick around, but go ahead.
Yeah, and then kind of be concise, so because I know our members do have questions for each of the testifiers just in terms of their business operations. Mr. Zhang, thank you for your testimony and the work that you're doing and the resilience in face of both of these challenges. Is it being able to be open, would that be one of the most predominant things that would help you and your vendors in your market? And I'm hearing that there's concerns with security and stuff to be open too. So I kind of see it as that we need some security and safety for the business owners to operate during the day and protect their stuff in the evenings. There's a little concern about that. But aside from the grants that could be forthcoming, how would being able to operate your businesses and get them going again, how would that help you?
Mr. Sure. I don't know if I understand your question exactly, but in terms of security, yes. For example, our income is so saturated, and we only have so and so a dollar coming every month. And the last 4 or 5 days, we have to increase a number of security, and we don't have any. We wish that we have more security. We have more funding to have more security. But we cannot. We have to go by our budget that allow us to do. So the last 4 days, we have been having difficult time. For example, this morning, we are reopened again. We have been reopened since yesterday. But today, we just reopened, and then we had very little security. We just have two security on board, and the marketplace is 5.86 acres. And we just got a situation this morning that one of our vendors came to the marketplace with a basket of lunch. And an African-American gentleman just ran into her and say, "This is my food. I am hungry. I want to take it." So instead of the lady going against him, she just let the gentleman take the food. So today she will not have any food for her lunch. If we do have funding, we would love to have more security. We have a lot of doors. We would like to have more security standing on those doors, making sure that the vendors are operating on a peaceful basis, but we cannot.
Representative Kosnick, did you have a second?
More police officers looping around the marketplace more often, showing their face so that any potential dangers will be scared away or will be alert to go away.
Representative Kosnick. Representative Kosnick, did you have another question?
Sorry, I thought I was unmuted. Thank you for the chance to ask the question, and I hope the committee and the people from Bead and the cities understand this, what he just told us, that in order to operate safely, and it's one thing to reopen, and there are food markets, so they've got that ability, but we do need to make sure that the businesses are able to operate successfully in terms of safety as well. And thanks for the testimony.
Mr. Herg.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me? I'm driving from California at this time. I'm actually parking my car in the rest area, so talking from my phone. I want to thank the representative, Stevenson, for sponsoring the bill. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, and members of the committee who take the time out of your very busy schedule. I know that this is very, during multiple crises, it makes you work twice as hard. And thank you for caring for Minnesota. My name is Thomas Herr. I'm the general manager at Hmong Village. Hmong Village has been around for about 10 years. We house more than 217 vendors, including four sections. We have professional offices. We have a pharmacy in-house. We have multiple lawyers. We have chiropractors and urgent care clinic. Then we have a produce section where you can shop, insiders can come anytime and purchase your produce day and night. Then we have a general merchandise. We have about 170 general merchandise there. We have about 24 kitchens, and Mount Village is fully rented. We have a waiting list of about 40 people. During this pandemic, we suffered a great time. So I'm not going to tell you how wonderful I have been or how I think I just want to second Mr. Zhang's testimonial just to make sure that all of you understand Hmong people came to America in the mid-76, right after the Vietnam War. And I personally came to America under the orphanage program when I was a week from 18 years, my 18 years birthday. So with that, I know we suffered a great time, and the funds that you put in the bill will help us greatly, because even though it's not going to help us everything that we need, it really replaces the loss from our rental income from our tenants. Even I want to tell you that for the last 3 months, even though we gave them a rent reduction of up to 50%, we still didn't get paid. Normally from the first to the fifth or the sixth, I would already collect 70% of my rent. And in the last 3 months, of the first to the sixth, I collected about 11% of the rent. Even I gave them 50%. Rent reduction. And that's how great of a suffering that Hmong Village and Hmong Town have been suffering. I want to also echo this point to our committee so that you have a better understanding why we are in such great help, great need of help. I would say about 90 to 95% of our vendors are self-funded individuals. They give up, they took out every saving that they have and borrow money from their families and clanships and first cousins to start their businesses. They get very little fund from all these fancy programs or the government funds because language is a barrier, number one. Number two is nowadays, technology is it's another venue of getting things done. And very few of these people understanding that back in 1976, when the Hmong first arrived in America, I would say 95 to 98% of Hmong women never held a pen in their life. So this will give you a better understanding why they don't understand English, and it, you know, it takes them so much to understand how the process works. So with that, saying to you, I hope that our committee understand the sense of urgency that our these two businesses need. I hate to say this, but I have to. I think it's for the record. These individuals that are running their businesses at Hmong Town and Hmong Village pay their tax just like anybody else. They're part of the vibrant economic growth that.
Tom, Mr. Herb, I think we've lost you, or.
Okay, can you hear me now?
We can. Okay. Could you close pretty quickly, sir, because we're running very long on time.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. So I just want to say that Hmong Village and Hmong Town wanted to be a part of your economy growth, economic growth, and Hmong Village and Hmong Town and all the vendors that are housed in these two businesses want to be part of the growing business, growing economy in Minnesota. with that, I'm going to conclude. And if you have any question, I can certainly answer. I want to say one last thing, because one of the representative asked the question of security. Since the Mr. Floyd's problem, the latest problem, we increased our security to almost triple, and we still have problem. We board up all the windows, and we still have problem. So security is a great issue for us, and we're not asking for security. We're asking for rent recuperation so that we can survive during this very complex and difficult situation. And with that, I want to thank you for working hard to protect the businesses in Minnesota and Hmong Village and Hmong Town want to be a part of it.
Thank you, Mr. Herr. I appreciate that. The last on the list is Kevin McKinnon from Deed. Mr. McKinnon, would you care to add to the testimony? Or do you want to just answer questions?
Mr. Chair, thanks, and appreciate being on here today. I'd be happy to answer any questions that may be out there about the language as well. So thank you.
I will open it up to questions, and we'll do the one question at a time, and we'll come back to people after they've had a chance to ask a question, rather than have three or four questions asked at the same time, and we have to cut people off. So with that being said, are there any questions for any of the testifiers that are still on the line? All right.
No, Mr. Chair, we can just read you the list. Representative Robbins has her name up, so has her hand up. She can go first, followed by Representative Baker, Representative Haley, and Representative Neuer.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. Appreciate everyone's engagement on this. And, you know, I really want to say up front that I realize this is not enough. But when I first had this idea, it was the second week of the shutdown. And now here we are nearly 3 months later. And I still am supporting this program. I think it's the right thing to do. But as has been said many times, the most important thing we can do is get all of our businesses to reopen safely. And so I realize that not everyone is going to get grants out of this, and I'm sorry about that, but we all hear you and understand that the best way you can save your business is to get it reopened. And so I will also continue to push for that. So I have a couple questions. I don't know if it's really mostly Representative Stevenson or Mr. McKinnon, but a couple of these things are different than the last time I saw the language, and you mentioned it had been agreed upon, but as the House Republican lead on this, I never saw this before this hearing, and I have not agreed, so I'm not sure who you agreed with, but it wasn't me. So if you could talk briefly about the section 4.7 to 4.11 about the money will be prioritized to businesses that are operating by executive, restricted from operating by executive order on May 18th. And that was just a bit confusing to me. So is that referencing a specific executive order, or is that referencing the end of session? And how does that priority for these businesses work with the lottery system that's also being used? And how will the lottery work? In a conversation I had earlier today, someone told me, well, if we get, you know, 20,000 applications, we can only afford 5,000 or 6,000. So 5,000 or 6,000 will get put in the lottery. Well, who decides which of those 5,000 or 6,000 gets in the lottery? Who's conducting the lottery, and is it publicly viewable? So those, if someone, either Mr. McKinnon or Representative Stevenson, if you could address those. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
Yeah, I can answer a few of those questions, and then I think there's a couple that I would ask Mr. McKinnon to comment on. At the outset, when I said there was agreed upon language, the agreement is between the House and the Senate and the governor. So we were negotiating with Senator Pratt on this bill and Commissioner Grove. As to your question about the language you referenced about eligibility, the bill does make anyone who has been affected by the pandemic eligible. There is priority for the businesses. The date in there is the close of session. We had at one point discussed doing a June 1st date, which is when the date that the restaurants and bars were allowed to have outdoor seating. But the Senate wanted to move it to May 18th. The 51% capacity does not stem from an executive order. We were just indicating that we wanted to limit or try and give priority to businesses that are still restricted, understanding that at this point there are a number of businesses that are back to operating at full capacity. And with our, as you note, our limited resources, we wanted to focus in on businesses that aren't able to do that. As for the logistics as to how Deed will administer that priority and conduct the lottery, I think those are questions that Mr. McKinnon can probably better answer than me.
Thank you.
Mr. McKinnon.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair. So the way that we have thought about this and to the point Representative Robbins made selections, I'll try to touch on all of it. Essentially, the way that we thought about conducting the lottery is that people would all apply in this 10-day window that's in there, and then a lottery would be conducted. So there would be, depending on how many businesses we're talking about, I've seen estimates of anywhere from 30 to 50,000 businesses. And so we would take in all the applications, conduct the lottery, and choose the 6,000 or 7,000 businesses at that point, recognizing some of the carve-outs that are obviously in the law. And then from there, our grantees, the nonprofits and the initiative foundations, would conduct due diligence on those folks and process the grants. So that's essentially how we would envision the lottery being set up and working. As it comes to who does the lottery and how public that is a good question, Representative Robbins, and one that, in fact, I've got staff talking about right now, and whether we need outside resources to actually conduct that for us, just so it's a third party, if you will, that's actually doing it, would make us a lot more comfortable, as I'm sure probably some of you as well.
Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. Probably for Mr. McKenna, because of the quick turnaround time, we're talking about a 10-day window when folks can apply, get on line quickly. What is the plan? I'm thinking Greater Minnesota, this is coming out to the initiative foundations. Will this be broken out fairly evenly with that part that's going to Greater Minnesota, evenly to those MIFs, or is it based on population? And then how do you plan on quickly getting this to the public and the businesses in need when we only have such a very, very short window of time for people to apply for this? Is it through EDA offices? Is it through local chambers? Can you explain the plan of getting the word out quickly outside of our communications that we representatives have? Help me with that. Those two questions, please.
Mr. McKenna.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair, and good questions, Representative Baker. That is one of the reasons that we are wanting to use our networks, as you indicate, particularly the initiative foundations, but also the nonprofits within the metro area for two reasons. Number one, the larger swath of education that these folks can provide in multiple languages. This is a key part for us to be able to engage these grantees immediately so that they can begin engaging their populations and ensuring that people can not only understand what's being required, but then meet that 10-day requirement for the lottery to be held. We'd be trying to do as much pre-planning, if you will, with a lot of the folks who are named in this. We did a little bit of this in the last round. Some of the testifiers that are on NDC, LEDC, we had calls for some time before the language was actually passed and the program began so that people could start preparing to do a lot of that outreach and to actually align their own staff to be able to conduct this. Those are great questions, Representative Baker, and certainly by the populations based on populations across Greater Minnesota is something that we've also thought about as to how you can put all that together. So those are great questions, Representative Baker. So I hope I answered them.
Thank you. I think for now that's it. I may have just a thought at the closing when we wrap it up, but I appreciate that. We'll let others ask a question. Thank you.
Representative Haley. And then after Representative Haley, we have Representative Noor, Representative Hassan, and Representative Zong. So Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think my question might be first for Representative Stevenson, the bill author, and then Mr. McKinnon with Deed. I want to clarify which businesses do not qualify for this program. And my understanding would be if they had received this SBA grant. But since we don't have the bill language, I wanted to be clear about that and the if they'd receive any other federal money. Does that make a difference or not? And then the follow to that for Mr. McKinnon, who will do that vetting? Will that happen from Deed after they conduct the lottery, or is that vetting done by the grantees? Thank you.
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Haley, to the question of who will do the vetting of the applications and essentially the monitoring and ensuring that the funds get out, yes, those are our grantees, which is also why we were trying to we want to take in the applications first so our partners aren't having to potentially review 30, 40,000 applications. We'd rather that that we limit that to the 5,000 or 6,000 or however many grants that we can do. So it minimizes the amount of work that they have to do and the utilization of some of those administrative resources that you're providing in this bill.
Representative Harry. Yeah, Representative Stevenson.
I just was going to answer the portion of the question that she directed to me, but perhaps it is better for Representative
Haley
if she doesn't follow up. Oh, okay. Well, Representative Haley, first of all, you should have a copy of the bill language. It was included in the packet that was emailed out to members. So I want to be clear that there is actual legislative language that all members do have access to. And your question relates to language on lines 4.28 to 4.30, which says that grants under this section may not be made to business that previously received a loan with funds appropriated in laws 2020, Chapter 71, and you can't get more than one grant under the section as well. So there is an exclusion for businesses that received an emergency small business loan from Deed. I believe your question related to small business administration loans, so federal loans, And I don't believe there is an exclusion in the bill for businesses that received federal aid previously. I'm having difficulty remembering whether the original House language had such an exclusion. It does make some sense to me. I know that that exclusion was present in the small business emergency loan program that we looked at earlier. But this portion of the bill was a Senate provision.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Haley. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. McKinnon and the Mr. Stevenson for the response. I guess it appears it could be problematic that the grantees do the vetting, and then we could have some applicants that get rejected at that point and kind of have to come back through the process potentially to reopen the money for additional business owners. And then just a final comment, very struck by the testimony from Mr. Zhang and Mr. Herr at the challenges that all small businesses face and what those two gentlemen described in their entire life history to build up these businesses is really the testimony from any small business we could hear in any corner of the state of Minnesota, that these folks put everything on the line, all of their resources, all of their savings, all of their sweat equity. And there will never be enough money in this bill or any subsequent bill to help everybody dig out of this hole that they're in. So more than the money, we need to get people open, because that's the only true path to allow these folks to continue the success that they have built over years and years of hard work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Chair Mahoney and Representative Stevenson, for bringing this bill forward. I know we have had several discussion about what needs to be happening. Small businesses needed help, and I'm glad that we're going to be providing them grants rather than loans. But I'm also interested in the technical assistance component that NDC and others have talked about. When you look at this bill, it's really, really small compared to what we should be providing at this difficult time. Just a quick question. Do we have other options to Deputy Commissioner in terms of providing technical assistance to the businesses?
I think that's a question for Mr. McKinnon.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, there's a couple things that that we're working on right now, and that is we run a program called the Competitive Grant Program, Business Development Competitive Grant Program, for which we have 14 grantees across the state who are providing business development technical assistance. One of the considerations that we've had is to send a letter to all of those folks asking them to prioritize businesses in this category, and to your point, providing that technical assistance. Furthermore, as many of you know, we are the lead center for the Small Business Development Center program, which is a program through the SBA. We not only have our core funding that we receive every year from the SBA of about $2 million that goes through 9 regional centers all across the state, but on top of that, we've received $3 million from the CARES Act to increase technical assistance for business that have been disrupted by this pandemic. And so we are in the process of working with our regional partners, which are for the most part higher education institutions and a couple of foundations, to increase the number of consultants that those programs offer, and to be doing direct outreach to those businesses. So I hope that helps answer that question, Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I think it does, but at least there were because of the situation that we're in terms of expanding that pool and encouraging other individuals, including working with the units that we're working with, is there any possibility in having additional groups who can provide the additional language support, the additional technical assistance we've had from some of this testifies about the language barrier? Is something that I'm looking forward to see in the technical assistance.
Mr. McKenna.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, that is one thing with our, with the federal resources that we got, we are going to be looking for partners, additional partners beyond our scope. NDC has been a partner with us in the past. We would certainly look to folks like that to the extent that they have the capacity to participate. We are definitely looking at any and all options at this point, because we too have timelines by which we have to spend all this money. And so we are working as quickly as we can through that, as well as trying to address some of the business assistance needs from this past week. So lots going on in that area.
I was a partner in this particular negotiations, and that $2.2 million was a Senate provision. And I've been working with Deed to kind of inform them of this particular part. We normally do about 5 to 8% for administration, and this is between 3 and 4% for administration. Hopefully we can figure out a way around that, or from funds from some other place or wherever. So yes, it is a concern for myself on how we make sure that people that don't speak English as a first language are served, because as was said before, these are entrepreneurs that we need to have in our communities, whether they're in Greater Minnesota or in the 7-county metro area. Representative Hassan, you had a question. Representative Hassan, are you on the line still? We'll skip over, because she has had problems in the last couple of days with her phone line because they have been without some services down in South Minneapolis. Representative Zong?
Really? Sorry.
Oh, no. Is that you, Representative Hassan? Representative Hassan? Travis, if you could work on that with Representative Hassan.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, sorry. I'm having mic issue. I had to put my headset on. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you everyone who is on the call. I want to thank all the testifiers for all the information that they have given us. A question that I had was, There are two Somali malls in the metro area, not in the metro area, at least in Minneapolis. And I don't know if anyone has reached out to the owners of these malls to invite them to this conversation. That's a question I have. And then the comment that I have is that it has been, many months since COVID-19 has hit, Minnesota and our communities. And this assistance is way overdue. And then in the last week, whatever COVID-19 did was added, more by the murder of George Floyd and all the destruction and the fires and what has happened to Lake Street. Many of the small businesses that we were advocating for, at least I was advocating for, are in that area. And now on top of COVID-19, they have to deal with, rebuilding their businesses. And some are actually thinking maybe they're not going to rebuild and it's not worth rebuilding after all of that has happened. So I think that as soon as we go into a special session that this bill needs to be passed and we need this funds, appropriated to these people, because at the end of the day, Lake Street is cultural corridor for Minneapolis, and we want to keep Lake Street alive, and we don't want to gentrify Lake Street. If we can rebuild the Lake Street and make sure that the black and brown, small businesses that are on Lake Street stays alive and people stay there, it will be, it will have a devastating impact on black, brown, and indigenous community in Minneapolis. So I want to, highlight that this is extremely important. The money may not be enough, but I really think that we should speed up this process on our end as much as we can to be sure that we can help people and make sure that, they can get the help that they need. And the other question that I have is on the ethnic mall. I think I heard that it's 250,000, and from the conversations I had with people, 250,000 is not enough for some of the big malls. So I don't know if there is a way to add more to this, but I certainly will welcome that conversation with whoever we need to have that conversation. Thank you.
Representative Hussain, I will be the first to admit that $2.5 million is not enough. I wanted to start at $5 million. We were not able to do that. This is a good start. You are correct. There's going to have to be more help to help those 1,500 small vendors that are tied to all of these particular malls. But we're going to start with this and see if we can keep them alive for a little bit longer. Representative Zong, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually just had some comments. First of all, I want to thank you for including many of our black and brown indigenous voices in a conversation of these last few days. And I also want to echo what my colleague, Representative Hoda Hassan had noted. I'm very concerned that
Representative Zong, you are breaking up. I don't know if anyone else is having that problem. I can't hear you, Representative Zong.
Mr. Chair, he seems to have dropped off the call. Maybe he's trying to get back on. I will let you know if he signs back on.
All right. We are way over time on this particular. So unless your question is really, really important, or you can't call Representative Stevenson, I will open it up for one. I see Representative Robbins had another question, and Representative Baker had another question. And if you could be quick, we would appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very quick. Representative Stevenson or Mr. McKinnon, if one of you could elucidate a little bit more clearly how this money for the cultural malls will work. I think there's a lot of confusion about why the $10,000 grant is given to the subgrantee. And then my understanding is, any mall gets $250,000. They can keep $10,000 of it for themselves, but the rest of it has to be given out in $10,000 grants to subgrantees who are tenants in the malls, of which $5,000 can be used for rent, and the other $5,000 they can use for whatever they want. That's my understanding. It's quite confusing. If I'm wrong, please correct me, but I just think it's important to get this on the record. And secondly, I just want to make a pitch that I appreciate and value the contributions of all the cultural malls in the state. I've been a frequent visitor of many of them and value them. But as a suburban representative, I just want to say there are a lot of minority-owned businesses in our suburban strip malls that aren't going to get this, and they are going under. And our suburban strip malls with nail salons and hair places and tattoo parlors and fitness centers, they are going under as well. So I just want to be a voice for the suburban malls, many of which are minority-owned restaurants and salons, and they are struggling too. So thank you.
You know, Representative Robbins, I will tell you that they are all available to the $10,000 grants that are make up $60 million worth of grants that we will be making. This $2.5 million for the malls is to do rent forgiveness for 250 in Hmong Village, 200 in Hmong Town, 200 in each of the Somali malls in South Minneapolis, and in up in St. Cloud, and I believe out in the southwestern corner of the state. So having said that, Representative Stevenson or Mr. McKinnon, would you care to comment?
Mr. Chair, I can be kind of quick here and try and explain a little bit about how these work. I think you did an excellent job of indicating why there's a provision specifically for these facilities, given their size and the number of vendors involved. It's just an efficiency prospect to do the work through the owner rather than try to process all of the vendors inside. That is not comparable to a suburban strip mall. And I represent lots, and I want them to get help, and they are eligible for help. But there's an efficiency factor and a fairness factor by using the operators of the mall to make those grants work in those cases. One important thing here is to understand that the grants are up to $250,000. They're not automatic grants for $250,000. So it's not guaranteed that any singular mall will get $250,000. There's flexibility for feed there. Certainly these malls are not all of the same size. There was consensus among the parties that we wanted the benefit to flow through the operator and to the vendors, that we didn't want the operators to get the benefit of these grants exclusively, and we wanted to benefit the vendors inside the mall. The Senate's approach was to say that all but $10,000 needed to flow through to the vendors. The $10,000 that they are able to keep themselves is simply a reflection of the fact that as a business, the operator is eligible for a $10,000 grant. The House approach was to say that we want the money to focus primarily on keeping existing tenants and that the money should be used primarily for rent forgiveness. The negotiated solution was to include both approaches, as we don't believe that they're mutually exclusive. Representative Robbins, your commentary about $10,000 grants to vendors and $5,000 for rent forgiveness, I think that that's far too prescriptive. That's not what the language in the bill indicates. The grants flow through to the vendors, and at least half of the overall money has to go for rent forgiveness, but it doesn't have to be $10,000 grants to specific sub-vendors. Again, these are all up to numbers, nor is there an exact dollar amount that has to go towards rent forgiveness. At least 50% of the total package has to go to rent forgiveness, but it could be more than that as well.
Thank you.
Representative Baker, can you get your question answered? We are way over time.
Yep, I know. And again, I appreciated Zach, Representative Stevenson's comments about having some dialogue with the governor's office and with Commissioner Grove about this bill. I plan on supporting it because it's not enough. We've got to get moving. But tell me, Representative Stevenson, how has your conversation gone with Commissioner Grove about getting businesses open quickly? That is the one thing that everybody wants. Not everybody has access to Commissioner Grove, and it has been very frustrating. I know I'm working with Representative Edelson on getting restaurants open by Monday, June 8th. Have you had conversations with Commissioner Grove and the governor's office and pushing them to get things open, Representative Stevenson? And what has the comments been?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baker, I had communications. I think all members have the ability to contact the governor's office and the commissioner staff, and I've certainly exercised that option on numerous occasions, advocating for my constituents in a lot of different ways. I think that's a little bit off topic from this bill, and given that we're way over, maybe you and I can connect afterwards and I can tell you more about what I said. I do think it's important to have, and sorry about my dog in the background if you can hear that, but I do think it's a really important subject and certainly one that I've been talking to the governor's office about.
As a jobs committee, we need to do some really strong stuff to get things open, because I think that's what everybody wants to do. So I appreciate that, but my requests have gone unanswered so many times, but thank you for that. Appreciate that.
Members, we are going to move along here to Representative Listigard's bill on 18-year-old high school students and unemployment. Thank you for all the good questions and the good comments. But this is a bill that has been negotiated. The small business grant program has been negotiated probably over 6 or 8 weeks now, and it is a very delicate balance, and this is probably the best that we will do at this particular time. So having said that, now we're going to move along to Representative Listigard, if he's on the line.
I am. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and committee members. Really quick, this was brought to me by an individual that was 18 years of old, and he lost his job due to COVID, which so many have. He was told to file for unemployment. He did. He actually got the amount back that he would have received, and then after further review, he was denied because he was in school. And to me, that just it just struck me as we want individuals to work, pay taxes, contribute to society, and do all of these things, and they do, and then to be denied, it just, to me, it wasn't right. So this bill is a temporary one due to COVID. It goes back to March 16th, and it will go all the way to December 31st of 2020. So that's what it is in a brief statement. I know you're short on time.
Well, thank you, Representative Listigard. I will cut a number of, you have five testifiers. They will each get 2 minutes. I am going to inform the committee at this particular time that I know there's other reasons to do this to do it deeper into the, rather than 18-year-olds, make it available to 17 and 16-year-olds. There was a request that we just do the 18-year-olds this year and have the Unemployment Compensation Advisory Committee take a look at this next year. They have a meeting in November, and then I think they have one in December or January of next year, but it would hopefully be able to be brought to the committee for further review, hopefully make some adjustments next year. This year, we are only, and I'm going to instruct the witnesses because of time, to limit their testimony to the need for 18-year-old high school students versus 17, 16, 14. So with that, Lincoln Bacall.
Yeah, hello, Lincoln Bacall. Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lincoln Bacall. I'm 17 and I live in Minneapolis and I'm a PSEO student at the University of Minnesota and a high school senior at Venture Academy in Minneapolis. A little bit about me, I run a youth advocacy and empowerment organization called Twin Cities Changemakers, which is focused on getting young people engaged with political issues that impact them and empowering them to make a difference. We firmly believe nothing about us without us, nothing, decisions shouldn't be made that impact us without us at the table, which is why I'm here talking to you all. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify. I lost my job because of COVID-19, and at the time I was the only one in my household working. I was encouraged to apply for unemployment by my employer, and however, I was denied because I'm a high school student. So I will now be taking a gap year in order to make up the money that I would have made in March through April of this year, so that I can pay for my college experience. I'm one of the youth leaders organizing the Support Working Youth campaign to ensure that every working Minnesotan is taken care of during this crisis. Right now, Minnesota is the only state in the country blocking high school students from receiving COVID-related aid. The federal government, through the CARES Act, created the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which is 100% federally funded, doesn't discriminate based on age or enrollment status, but DEED decided that high schoolers aren't eligible for the PUA in Minnesota because of a 1939 law that blocks student access to unemployment insurance. This law was created because Green Giant didn't want to pay unemployment insurance to their high school workers. What we're asking for is a short-term and essential fix. Many high schoolers urgently need this money now for rent, food, and other household needs. And I would just like to quickly address this suggestion that this be limited to high school students 18 plus. And like, with all due respect, many of us can't wait until next year. Like, high school students have the same needs and the same struggles right now that other working Minnesotans do. And this is essential. So I'd like to thank you all for the work that you're doing to help Minnesotans through this crisis. And please, I'd like to urge you all to please not forget about our state's most vulnerable youth. This is an urgent issue. And if we limit it to high school students 18 plus, it would only widen existing disparities and harm low-income working youth. And it would also provide an incentive for high school students 17 and younger to drop out of high school in order to become eligible for benefits. If the option is between feeding your family and dropping out of school, I think many people are going to choose to take care of their family. So thank you all again for the opportunity to testify. And that's what I've got. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bechtel. Walter Cortina?
Hi, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify yourself for the tape and, sir, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
I'm Walter, I'm Cortina. I'm 17 years old and I'm a student at High School for Recording Arts in St. Paul. I'm also, I'm the leader of Bridgemakers, an organization that's committed to supporting and mentoring the voice and leadership of youth as they help break cycles of poverty and miseducation and violence. And I really just wanted to share a little bit about my story and how having the bill 18 plus isn't the best that it could be, especially for students who might have been like in my situation. And so I have been taking care of myself since I was 13, because my mom, she just wasn't in my life anymore, and neither was my dad. And so I was financially responsible for myself, for my rent, for my food, and for everything. And I was only 14 years of age. And I know a lot of other students and youth who are in the same position. And so I just want everyone to keep in mind that there is students out there who are below the age of 18 who do pay rent and help support their families and contribute a lot. And Lincoln was saying, this bill, like, is an incentive for students to drop out. Like she said, if people had the choice to choose between school and taking care of their family, of course they would take care of their family. And especially, I think, during this time of crisis, it's not the best to limit this because Minnesota has the most racially divided group of workers. And as we see what's going on in the country, people of color, they aren't getting the best treatment that they can. And so I just want everyone to keep that in mind. Yeah, and that's all I have to say. And just thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you. The next is a Cole Stevens.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sharon, members of the committee. My name is Cole Stevens. I'm 18 years old. I live in Bloomington, Minnesota. I am a student at Roosevelt High School. Number one, I want to thank you guys for allowing us the opportunity, us young people, to talk to you. And right away, I'm going to be concise here. I'm going to kick this off by saying that we fought a war over this, on the idea of no taxation without representation. I pay my income taxes, I pay my sales taxes, and just like any other insurance policy, unemployment insurance, you pay into it when times are good, you take out of it when times are rough. Times are rough, I can't take out of it. My fellow high school students, they can't take out of it. It's ridiculous, in my opinion. I've been taking care of my family and helping my dad to pay the bills. That includes utilities, rent, internet, phone. I've been paying those bills and helping him pay those bills since 2018. I've been working not only as a freelance worker that is fixing bikes, I do video editing, I am an audio engineer and a musician. I've been doing that since 2018 to help pay the bills. And also I've worked at a coffee shop for a very long time since it just started getting cold last year, since just before that. And I lost my job due to no fault of my own because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'm unable to get those unemployment insurance benefits. Now, the one thing that really sucks here is that the law is very unclear. My colleagues, my family, and my employer told me to apply for unemployment insurance. I did. And actually, I wasn't accepted for a little while, but then being moved over to pandemic unemployment since I was accepted. And upon being accepted, I was paid retroactively for like 5 weeks. Now, I was already behind on bills, me and my father were, so I paid for phone, I paid for internet, I paid some of the utilities, and I paid a chunk of the rent, all on that day, because we needed to get that done, and about 3 days later, that was when I had received the letter from Deed that actually I was ineligible, and they were demanding that money back, the order of $1,314, so me being actually a young, aspiring entrepreneur, it has always been my my dream. I know you guys are the jobs committee. I hope that this resonates with you. It has always been my dream to actually start a business and create jobs in my community for people like me. And that business would be music production. So basically, I would help vocalists and artists take their song ideas and actually make it real. And make it up to industry standard. And that was my business idea. I was planning with my future unemployment funds. Actually, I was allocating everything. I had everything written down to start this business. And right now I cannot because I am currently in debt to the state of Minnesota. Now, there are other people in debt to the state of Minnesota who are high school students who are younger than me. Ezra, Cameron, Abdirzak, and Brianna, those are people that I know from around Minneapolis and outside, further out in the rural areas of the state as well. Just off the top of my head. They've also spent their benefits on core family expenses and personal expenses. And some of these people take care of themselves completely, such as my colleague Walter. Mm-hmm. And you know what? They're also now in debt to the state. Worse than broke before this whole thing happened, they're now in debt. And that's awful to hear. Now, I want to say right away that with everything going on, the murder of George Floyd and the things that we're seeing after that, that this is really, really urgent because this disproportionately affects people of color communities. And it's awful. It's disheartening mm-hmm. to see my people of color communities going through this sort of thing. But, you know, I want to keep this concise. I just want to say that this is urgent. And, you know, young people are going to be leading the charge on things here. And I think that you guys want to be the administration that clears the road for them to do that. And I thank you guys very much for allowing me to speak. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. DeAnthony Akan.
Hello, I'm here. Can you give me 1 second? I just have to go to this back. I'm in the middle of doing an event for a food bank in the community, which is giving food and resources to a lot of people in the community who have been affected by COVID, the rioting,
You've broken up, Mr. O'Connor.
Yeah. His feed appears to have frozen. Might be coming back.
Sorry. Can I be heard?
Mr. Akan, we did not hear anything. Why don't you start over? Yes, I can hear you now. Can you start over, identify yourself for the tape, and proceed?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the rest of the council. My name is DeAnthony Akon, a 20-year-old high school student, which at one point was a dropout, but I was able, thanks to my community and the people who reached out to me, to go back to school and get my education. I'm also a PSEO student, so I go to school in St. Paul, and I go to PSEO in Minneapolis, and I live in Brooklyn Center right now. And I've been affected by the not being able to get unemployment because I'm a high school student, even though I've had multiple jobs, and I have had a job until COVID hit, and I was told that the establishment that I was working at would be closed down. And it's really hit hard because I've been in a position where I've had to, try to seek help and get like financial support for my family ever since I was 13. I've been looking for jobs and ways to support my family and doing community work and ways to support my community. My goal is to be an entrepreneur that provides job opportunities for many people in the community who need a chance to change the narrative and who needs a second chance. But like, I can't do that because I can't invest in myself anymore because my job has been affected by COVID and I'm not able to get any type of unemployment benefits, even though I pay my sales tax and my income tax. And my little sister who filed for unemployment, who also pays her sales tax and income tax, got approved but then got denied. So now she's in debt as well. And her goal, like her only thing is just trying to be able to support for her child. And I feel like questionable that a person can pay sales tax and income tax, stuff like that, but still not be represented by the state and still not be taken care of and insured in case their job is put in jeopardy because of things like this that happen. And that's all I want to say right now.
Thank you, Mr. Akon. Thank you. We're going to move on to Mr. Peterson. I think it's Jalan Peterson.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you very much for your time here today. It is a privilege to be allowed to speak before you. But respectfully, Mr. Chair, I will be continuing with my original statement in defense of students under the age of 18. Because if no one is coming forward to speak about this, then I will take that as my responsibility. My name is Ajalon Peterson, and I'm a 17-year-old resident of Minneapolis. I'm speaking in support of the bill regarding temporary unemployment insurance eligibility for secondary students. As a guard, I would like to thank you for recognizing this need. However, I disagree with the recent edit that unemployment insurance may only be granted to individuals age 18 and over, as I don't think the age requirement accurately addresses the conditions that I believe it intends to, and for additional reasons that I will expand upon shortly within my 2 minutes. I come before you today because this bill that we are discussing directly impacts my life and the future of my academic career. I believe it sadly holds that power for many residents of our city. I have been financially independent since I was 16 years old, paying rent and bills without the help of others. As a responsible young person, I had never previously struggled financially before COVID-19, and had never sought any form of aid, governmental or otherwise. What little time I had left after school and working at least 3 days a week was spent volunteering. I'm a very passionate member of this community. I'm a PSEO student, and I second the stance of Ms. Bacall. For those of you who don't know, this is a form of concurrent enrollment in which a student may take courses as if they were at the collegiate level. Dual credit is awarded to both the institution and the high school where the student is in attendance, contributing to graduation requirements. While taking these college courses, I was able to maintain a 4.5 cumulative GPA and score 33 on my first ACT, setting my educational prospects high. With the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, I lost my job and thereby all income. I applied for unemployment insurance and was able to view what my weekly benefit payment would be, but was denied on the grounds that I was technically enrolled at a high school.
not because I did not meet the hourly requirements, as many high schoolers don't, and not because I hadn't been working and paying taxes for years. So setting my rent bill and my projected weekly benefits side by side, I was confronted with the decision that no 17-year-old should have to make. Do I drop out of school and sacrifice my long-term future for my immediate well-being? I'm sure that when the current law in place was written in the 1930s, they weren't thinking 80 years in the future to its applicability during COVID-19. It assumes that these secondary students are coming from a place of privilege and that they are dependents. My denial based on this technicality assumes that I am not able to work during the school year, when in fact, in all ways except for a small discrepancy on my transcript, PSEO students are college students. I ask you, should that discrepancy on my transcript determine the roof over my classmates' head and not mine? If we are addressing the recent development, why should a fellow PSEO student in my grade but several months older be able to receive unemployment benefits regardless of their financial responsibility? The Alabama Unemployment Compensation Handbook addressing benefit rights and responsibilities has already addressed this flaw, specifying that students attending GED classes, a college, or a vocational school may receive benefits so long as they make themselves available for work. High school students are denied only if they are regular full-time students. I believe that Minnesota was trying to replicate the logic applied here, but that they failed to do so by excluding any type of high school student, regardless of their circumstances. This assumption is dangerous to our society and threatens the integrity of our system and the effective dispersal of taxpayers' money. By not honoring the validity of this argument, you are jeopardizing the future of the city and the taxpaying citizens within it. I don't believe that the 18-year-old benchmark effectively addresses the eligibility concerns that it intends to, and with every similar assumption made, that leaves thousands of dollars from taxpayers' pockets. It also threatens the well-being of students like myself who may be independent and in some ways flying under the radar with no unemployment benefits, no stimulus checks, and no available work. Non-high schoolers' employment situations are being evaluated in the context of modern times, and I believe that provided they meet all other requirements, we owe that to high schoolers as well. Requiring secondary students to be of age 18 or older certainly makes a respectable attempt at evaluating the eligibility of students, but I believe that other concessions must be made in order for the bill to be most efficient. I would argue that this is an obligation to Minnesota taxpayers to ensure the rationality of the requirements for all individuals receiving unemployment benefits. I don't write bills, but I do ask that in addition to the overall revision of the current law, that eligibility concessions similar to the ones that Alabama describes also be made available to students in Minnesota, as I believe that this is a more effective way to evaluate students' situations. I recognize that addressing every student's individual situation may not be feasible at this time, but at the very least, I believe that eligibility should be extended to this particular.
Mr. Chair, will we be able to hear from Deed about this bill too?
I don't know if they are in the on the call at all at this particular time.
Okay,
we'll find out.
Okay, I'd like to follow up with that. Thanks.
Ms. Peterson, could you come to a conclusion?
Yep,
you're well over the couple minutes.
For your time and for hearing my story today. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Is Deed in the audience? Is Deed in the audience still here? Representative Haley, you have a question? Could you be brief? Because we are well over time with two more bills, two more pieces to the committee hearing today.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can email this to Deed. I think there were a number of things stated by testifiers that need clarification. And I'll just name a couple. And again, I can send an email to Deed. I think it's important for the committee to understand accurately. I believe that unemployment is available for students pursuing a GED degree. It's not clear to me whether Minnesota is the only state that does not provide UI to these students. I think that was misstated. And I'm not clear whether if employers are paying into our UI system for 18-year-old workers, nor if this bill qualifies them if they are not full-time workers. So just many questions, Mr. Chair. I know you're under a time constraint today, but I think that tells us that there's more work to do regarding this subject before we can approve a bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Representative, I thought there was another one here. There's no one from Deed on the call. Can House Research answer any of those particular questions of Ms. Representative Haley? House Research?
I'm sorry, I didn't unmute myself. Mr. Chair and members, Martha James from House Research. I can speak to some of these questions, but I would urge members to reach out to Deed directly for answers. My understanding of the PUA is that some state law may still determine eligibility for whether or not high school students would be eligible. Some states do allow, under regular state law, for high school students to receive unemployment insurance. Not all states do. Under Minnesota law, that obviously is not the case. Under existing Minnesota law, high school students do not qualify. I can't speak to whether or not Minnesota is the only state that is interpreting the CARES Act and PUA that way. But like I said, individual state law may have some impact on the interpretation. And I'm trying to think what the other questions were. I don't know if Representative Haley wants to repeat.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to email in the interest of time today, since we, as you said, we still need clarification from Deed. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. To Representative Listigard, I think your bill has a little work to do and to see where the Senate is. If the Senate will take all of that, I'm sure we can work something out with Deed and have something ready for any special session coming forward. So I suggest you contact your co-author over in the Senate and see if he can do some legwork. We're going to move on to the shared work plan. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that I'm happy to bring to the committee today. The idea came from a constituent, and I'm hopeful that committee members that have questions or concerns can share them with me either in the committee or afterwards, because it's still a little bit of a work.
Representative Stevenson, I think you need to get closer to your phone. You keep breaking up.
I apologize. Hopefully that's better. This is a bill that came to me from a constituent, and we're still working on it. I'm working with Senator Rarick in the Senate on this language, and so I'm hopeful that if members have questions or concerns that they'll bring them forward either in the hearing or by email, because we are still working on this idea. I do want to give members just a brief background on what the shared work program is before I discuss the bill, in particular in case that you, like me, knew less about it before hearing about this. So here's a description of the program that was written by Deed. It says, administered by our unemployment insurance division, the shared work program allows employers to divide available hours of work among a group of employees instead of implementing a full layoff. These employees may then receive partial unemployment insurance benefits while working reduced hours. The purpose of shared work is to avoid a layoff, not to subsidize wages. Shared work can help employers avoid the difficulties that go along with a layoff. If employees keep working during a temporary slowdown, employers can then quickly gear up when business conditions improve. So an example of this might be that if a business needs to cut labor costs by 15%, one solution is to lay off 15% of employees, but another solution would be to reduce all of employees' hours by 15%. A business might want to go that route. They may want to do the 15% across the board cut, but it's really hard for all these employees to take such a big pay cut. So the shared work program allows people to obtain unemployment assistance even when they would normally not be eligible because they hadn't suffered enough of a reduction in hours. There's a lot of benefits to shared work programs. They allow businesses to keep experienced and trained staff. They avoid future hiring and training costs. It allows businesses to quickly increase operations once the business conditions improve. And it also avoids layoffs, which of course is good for all people. I want to tell you a little bit more about how the program works. Employers have to submit a plan to the UI office, but they manage the plan. Importantly, all of the employees under the plan get to keep their health and pension benefits the same as before. Also, the employees that participate in the plan have to be full or part-time. They can't be seasonal or temporary. And this is the important part for this bill. They have to have been with their employer for at least 1 year. This bill would change that requirement, bringing it from 1 year to 3 months. And as I mentioned, this is a bill that came to me from a constituent. I am a constituent who has worked for a major company in the metro area for 8 months now. They have a shared work plan, he's now working 80%, but he's unable to get the benefit of the shared work because he hasn't been there for a full year. It turns out that this is actually one of the most restrictive requirements in the country for shared work plans, and I want to thank Ms. James for her excellent research in helping me get my head around how shared work plans work and what the landscape is around the country. No other state has a one-year requirement. Many states, including Arkansas, Kansas, Maine, Missouri, Nebraska, and Rhode Island, and others, have no length of employment requirement at all. My bill, instead of going to no requirement, takes kind of a middle approach, temporarily reducing the length of unemployment requirement to 3 months. That's consistent with four other states, including Maryland, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and our neighbors in Wisconsin. My bill makes this requirement, relaxes this requirement on a temporary basis with a sunset at the end of calendar year 2020. The reason why I did that was I wasn't sure when I was writing the bill how much this would cost and the state, and I thought that if we sunset it at the end of the year, we might be able to make the cost eligible to be covered by the federal funds we've received through the CARES Act. But after we got the bill language drafted and requested a fiscal note, the fiscal note came back with a very pleasant surprise. As it turns out that some federal legislation passed earlier this year has the federal government picking up the entire cost of shared work plans through the end of 2020. So accordingly, this bill has no fiscal cost to the state at all, $0. To be clear, we don't spend any state general fund dollars, nor do we spend any of our CARES Act money to make this benefit eligible to more Minnesotans in the middle of the pandemic. So it really is a win for the state to be able to do this. I have had conversations with my local chamber, with the Minneapolis Regional Chamber, who are both initially very positive. I'm going to continue discussing it with them. As I mentioned, I've had conversations. I'm working with Senator Rarick on this in the Senate, and I'm very interested to hear any feedback or questions from members of the committee, and certainly could take that by email if there is time today.
Are there any questions for the author?
I would have one if nobody else is speaking up. I'm not using the hands on the participant thing. Just
go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stevenson, how was it determined the length of time for eligibility from down to 3 months of employment rather than the current 1 year, maybe 6 months or something? How was that determined?
So existing law is 1 year. As I mentioned, we're the only state in the country that has a one-year requirement. In fact, I don't think any other state is even close to 1 year. Many states have no requirement at all. I went with 3 months. Frankly, my constituent suggested to me that Wisconsin was at 3 months and we should adopt that model. So that's what I put in the bill initially. And then I received the research showing that most states that have shared work programs don't have any requirement of employment history with their current employer, four have this 3 month requirement. So I'm sticking with the 3 months for now. It makes sense based on what our neighbors are doing, but I will note that there's a lot of states out there that don't have this requirement at all.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair, and interesting bill idea. And if we're going to follow the suit of Wisconsin, I think a lot of these businesses and jobs would do well to also follow Wisconsin by opening more and being less restrictive.
Representative Kosnick, I have always believed science is a better indicator of what we should be doing. Having no other questions, we're going to move on to the Department of Labor and Industry and OSHA standards, if they are still on the line, and if the commissioner has been on the list to testify and to present, but she may have had to go elsewhere. I'm sure they're very busy at the present time. So, is Labor and Industry on the line? Is Labor and Industry on the line at all?
This Members, is Nicole.
Hello.
Sorry, Chairman Mahoney. This is Nicole Blissenbach, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. I do see the commissioner's phone number on the screen, but it looks like she's on mute. So I just wanted to say she is on.
Oh, good. I was going to make her come back next week. members, it's getting late. Commissioner Lepik, if you're on the line or someone can unmute her. This was one of the issues that I had really wanted to take up. If the commissioner is busy, we are likely to have another hearing next week, Wednesday or Thursday of next week.
Yes.
There are a couple other issues that we have to deal. Commissioner Lepik?
This is Nancy Lepik, Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you for making time today.
Chairman Mahoney, I would be happy to come back next week to allow for time for the testimony and questions, if that would be a convenience for you.
Well, we are a bit over, and the speaker has frowned on these particular things. So, members, I am going to ask the commission to come back next week and do a presentation, and you'll be first on the list to do your presentation on labor and industry and OSHA statutes and status in the state of Minnesota. I really want our members to be able to pass along to their constituents and give you a platform to tell workers that they have nothing to fear if they ask questions about their safety. So thank you again, Madam Commissioner. Why don't we
sure.
I'll have Travis Kett reach out and set it up for you. So thank you again.
So thank you. I'm happy to do it.
Thank you. Representative Cagle has a question. If it's to OSHA, I'm going to ask you to just call the commissioner or the commissioner connect up with you so you can ask that question. Otherwise, we'll get into everyone wanting to have a question in it.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to convey that, you know, workers do need to be their own advocates. I had an issue in my district where an employer was forbidding them to wear face masks. I did contact Dolly and got the complaint filed with MnOSHA, and that situation was quickly resolved. So I will mute myself now so you don't have to listen to a crying child.
members, with no further business in front of the committee, you all have my phone number because I've been calling you all week long. You have the author, Representative Stevenson of the first bill, Representative Lestegaard with the last bill. And if he can convince the Senate to drop that number, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm very open to trying to make this make that a different bill. With that, I am going to close I'm going to call for adjournment unless there's objection. I'll give you a second to object. Seeing no objections, these bills, we're not sure how it's going to play out when we get to special session. I hope we can come to agreement on all of them. Thank you. With that, we are in a